Greaves, and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you the first program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Bob Bright.
Bob, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me into your home. And can I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
Born in Watford, in England, which is a little sort of outer suburb of London. It's about 19 clicks north of London. And then 1945.
So does that mean you were born just after the war was over, or while the war was happening?
Yeah, well, I was born, I think the war went on for about 2 or 3 months after I was born.
Right.
I do remember being told I was put in an oven once to save me in case the bombs dropped. But
oh, right. My, you know, well, talking about things you've been told, what would be your earliest memories then?
Earliest memories? I think it's, yeah, well, when I sort of search for that, there's 2 or 3 things coming to mind, but they're all related to the same house.
Oh.
I must have been about 4 or 5. And that earliest I recall is being allowed to stay up, watch out at the back window across the main highway that was at the back of the house. Well, actually, there was a giant paddock we used to call the spinney. This is in England, yeah?
Yeah.
And the other side of the main highway there was where circuses and such things set up. And I was allowed to stay up this night to watch a guy set himself on fire and jump off tower into a bucket of water. You know?
Wow.
So that making igloos out of when you have a really good snowfall, the land at the back of the house was all little hillocks and stuff.
Right.
So snow would gather. It would look flat, but if you knew where the hillocks were, you could dig in there and build a little igloos. I remember doing that.
Yeah.
And just basically mucking around in the spinney, which was like a little, I guess you'd call it just bush, really.
What was your family home like? Have you got memories of that?
It was 2-storey. I think semi-detached, like 2 houses together.
Sure.
You know.
Yep.
As I say, a garage out the back that went onto this large paddock that it was sort of like the outer suburbs of Melbourne now, you know, where you'd be in a sort of a built-up area and all of a sudden there's paddocks that go for miles next to you. So it was that sort of area.
Which is not generally the image of most people have of England.
No.
You know, it's like crowded streets and...
Yeah. Well, one of the things that amazed me of actually flying into England when I went there years later was how much greenery there is there, you know. You look down on where you're flying into and a large percentage of it looked like open spaces.
Amazing.
Isn't it? Yeah. But see, that's... we came totally off topic, but that's why in England people don't know their way out of their own street pretty much, you know. They've been basically trained to stay in the one little area because if everyone started wandering around, it'd be a hell of a mess.
but that's actually an interesting observation because generally... whole generations tend to live in the same area, don't they?
Definitely.
Mum and Dad, what do you remember about Dad?
Not a lot, really, because, well, we left England when I was 7 and he stayed there. I came here with my mother.
Right.
He did visit a couple of times during my life, once when I was about 11 and once when I was older, when I was about 17, 18. He was an engineer. He used to... working gold, like spinning tiny little flywheels, etc., on lathe out of gold for rocket parts.
You know, okay.
Because gold doesn't expand. Or he liked fishing, and he was always planning on building a catamaran. I remember that, but you know, I don't think it ever happened. He might have built a model one after I left. But I don't know. You know.
So Mum was really your main...
Mum and I came to Australia, yeah.
What sort of woman was she? As a child, how did you see your mum?
Well, you know, I thought she was a very confident person when I was very young, but I found out later she wasn't. You know, she was very nervous, sort of almost too frightened to walk into a shop and ask for something, one of those sort of English people, you know. But, however, she bluffed it out very well to me, you know. She was good to me. I always had anything I Well, I was going to say I had anything I wanted. That's not true. It wasn't like I was lavished with things, but sure. I never wanted for necessities, you know, yeah. for school, and I never felt like I was worse off than the other kids who had a dad as well, you know.
Yeah. So did she have to work being the main person?
Oh, yeah. She worked for a firm called MTPA, which was the Mercantile Trade Protection Association.
Oh, that's very wordy.
It's a long word for debt collectors.
Oh, okay.
But she worked there from the time, that was the first job she got when she came to Australia, and she worked there till she retired.
Wow, okay. Mm. Do you remember anything about the journey coming to Australia?
Oh, again, it's flashes, you know. Like, I remember the first night out, we hit the Bay of Biscay, which is traditionally one of the roughest places. It's like Bass Strait, you know. It's okay. Known for its weather that you never can judge. And, yeah, I remember being sick when I got up that morning. And I was fine walking around feeling a bit wheezy until someone vomited in front of me.
Oh, God. That was it.
That was it, you know. So that was the bad memory. So the next memory I have, other than just general ship stuff, was waking up in a tiny little bay that where on either side of the ship there were mountains that went to the sky with snow on top. The water the boat was moored in was so clear you could see the bottom, and you could see octopus swimming around and sort of thing. And at the head of where these mountains sort of met, there was a little village that seemed, yeah, just there at the end of the bay.
That's something out of a movie.
Well, and down, it even gets better for the movie. Down towards where you could see there was a dock, there was this long stream of people, and they were all dressed in black. And that was like, what is going on? It was actually Greeks who were running, Archbishop Macarius, the whole thing that was going down in the late, early 50s. It was civil war and stuff.
Right.
And these people were coming to Australia as refugees.
Wow.
And they were scary. I mean, you know, I'm this sort of little waspish English boy who's 7 with pimples, and there are these Greeks with sort of shaved bald heads looking like they could eat you for breakfast.
All dressed in black.
All dressed in black, and they didn't even speak English. God damn, you know. So and it was Kalamata, where the olives come from.
Right.
Which is a tiny little island off the coast of Greece. And it wasn't on the ship's planned route. It must have been an emergency where these people needed to be taken on.
Okay.
So that was a really pleasant surprise, amazing place on earth. You know, the water was swimming pool blue.
Well,
Mediterranean.
It obviously had a profound impact that you recall that part of it so clearly.
Mm, yeah, well, that was one. The next was Port Said, which was just about the time when NASA had reclaimed it from the British. So we weren't allowed off the boat. We were British.
Oh, right.
So we had to stay on the boat there. But the boat was serviced by little boats that come in. They call them bum boats. That come and, you know, chuck a rope up and, you know, you can buy bags, leather bags of elephants or whatever, you know. And then went on through the Suez Canal. Memory of Suez Canal was just sandstorm that just hit as we were going along. You know, one minute you're just cruising down this eerie canal, eerie because it's desert either side of you. It's just miles and miles and miles of sand. And at some stages there's a little tributary, so there'd be a boat sailing, or, you know, not sailing, but what do you call it, motoring or going along the parallel canal.
Wow.
So it looks like they're just blowing through the sand, and then there's all these people. I'm saying to my mum, why are they wearing their pyjamas? And then all of a sudden, storm up, sand coming in, quick, get inside. So everyone went. And when we've gone through it, there was an inch of sand on everything on the the right-hand side of the boat. And it was, you know, like it was just stuck there. And it would have split your skin, I'm sure, if you were stuck out there.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So there was that. Then we went to Bombay. Well, great memories of colours and snake charmers and mongooses fighting snakes in the street.
So you got off at Bombay, did you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow, that must have been, even for a young kid, that must have been an eye.
It was a mind, yeah. The first thing was beggars, you know. I mean, as you get off the boat, there's all these beggars come to you on little, what looked like skateboards, but, you know, they were just little trolleys back then.
Was that a curio for you, or was that scary?
It was weird, you know. The whole Bombay was all weird. You know, in a taxi and you can't move because there's a cow in the way and we have to wait till it gets off the road. Right. You know, don't drink the water, drink Coca-Cola, you know.
Okay.
The taxi driver says to mother, would you like to go and see the women in cages? Mother, how dare you ask me that? I'm a young boy with it. I'm going, women in cages? Oh, what's that?
So that was my boggles.
Yeah. And I still recall, like, the difference between rich and poor, or it wasn't so much rich and poor, but buildings, you know, there'd be the traditional English sort of Georgian mansion thing with mud huts the other side of it.
Of course.
You know? And you go, wow, that's different. And now the other one, we went to Ceylon, or Sri Lanka as it is now. And my memory of that was we were there on the day of the Festival of the Flowers, and there was all the Buddhist monks in saffron robes, marching through the street with, you know, gongs and tingy tingy, and all the buildings had flowers on strings up the faces of them, you know, and it just blew my mind. That really, I'd never, that image has never left me, really.
No, I mean, for an adult that would have been quite something else, but for a child that must have been just almost out of the world.
Well, it certainly showed me that there's a lot of ways to living on the planet.
Yeah.
Not just the way I was used to, you know. Not, I mean, the difference between the Greeks and the Indians, and it was just
everything,
1,000 miles of difference.
So was it different when you got to Australia? Did that actually impact you as much?
Well, Australia was, again, an interesting place, you know, familiar yet totally alien. You know,
so where did you first land, do you remember?
I landed Fremantle.
Of course.
And you do what everyone from England does, they get off of Fremantle and go, ah, grass, let's walk on it with our shoes off because we've been on a boat for a month, you know. I think that's everyone I've ever spoken to has done that, you know. And then Adelaide, you know, I got off in Adelaide because we were coming to live with my grandparents, my mother's parents.
Right.
Who lived in Adelaide, and he was a surveyor general or something, you know. He'd been brought out by the South Australian government to, you know, pontificate on the new buildings, etc., etc. He was a case in himself. He was ex-Marine, one of 12 kids, who taught himself, basically taught himself everything. I think he left school at about 7.
Wow.
You know, and there he goes, finishing up being the head architect in South Australia.
Yeah.
And there's a family rumour that he was involved building bunkers for Churchill during the war. You know, who knows whether that stuff's true. You know, you like to believe it.
Right, listen, never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, well, that's true too.
So did you stay with them, or did you...
Yeah, so we didn't have to suffer the ignominy of staying in the hostel.
Right.
So I moved straight into this street in Adelaide where, wow, people actually spoke to you and smiled as you walked up the street, and my God, there's a woman driving a car. Ooh, never seen that before. Trains were like they were in the old Western movies compared to the trains I was used to.
Right. You know? Now, this might sound like a strange question, but generally when I talk to people of our parents' age about the post-war in England, they still talk about lots of shortages. As a kid, did you notice the difference between Australia and England in terms of things like food and drink and things like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I had my first real taste of orange juice on the boat coming out. And, you know, here in Australia you could go and buy a bag of oranges any time you liked, which I hadn't seen in England. Things like milkshakes, God, what's that?
Right.
No, I'd never seen that. I don't remember it being, you know, I wouldn't say we ever went hungry or anything like that.
Yeah.
However, I've had all my life a natural aversion to red meat. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't go past my neck ever since I remember. And maybe that had something to do with the poor quality of meat that was available in those 5 years after the war. Because I do remember my mother talking about coupons, but I don't actually remember seeing coupons swapped for something.
You must have been, what, 7 or 8 when you got to Adelaide?
Yeah, sir.
So you're definitely school age.
Yeah, I went straight into grade 4.
What was that experience like?
Oh, dear. Right at school, first day, I've taken my books to show me, to her, my work, where I'm at, what I do. she's instantly realised that I'm 3 years ahead of what she's teaching.
Oh, really?
And then she's held up my book to the client saying, look how neatly this person from England...
Oh, thanks very much,
set you up
dear.
Beautifully, yeah.
You know? So, consequently, I used to get the job of, sitting next to the new immigrant from Italy or Germany or Poland and teaching them how...
Almost a teacher's aide.
Exactly that. So until... that was so until about grade 7, you know. By then it had caught. I was into the system.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, all through primary school, I basically had German, Italian, Polish friends. Friends, good friends, you know. But basically I'd met them because I was introduced to them. I had to tell Franco, the Italian, mate, you can't go around eating the grasshoppers on the oval. People just don't handle it, you know. But why they? I thought they were good food.
Oh, look.
What can you say?
But you also, if you try and cast your mind back to those times and who we're dealing with, you can understand why they would do that.
Oh, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So you didn't have any trouble actually making friends?
No, I was able to. I mean, I cottoned on pretty quick that, there are different words for things in Australia, you know, that people don't know what you're talking about if you... I can't actually think.
No, but kids generally pick up on that quicker than adults, don't they?
Yeah,
they're very quick to adapt.
I was quite athletic, so you know, I was fine there. You know, I was playing Aussie rules. I think I'd only been in the country about 2 months or something.
Wow, that's something.
I was still playing soccer for a little club up the road, but gradually Aussie rules won out because, well, it was played on Friday afternoons. You got an afternoon off school. Soccer was played Saturday morning, and you were buggered from playing footy all afternoon on Friday.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I enjoy. I could never kick straight because I'd learnt playing soccer, and with soccer you tend to hit with the instep and the inside of your foot. You know, you're actually... Yeah. Whereas Australian rules, it's a straight foot and follow through, you know. So I could mark well, but...
kicking?
Have three guys standing there, one of them might get it.
The right angle's got it.
So don't make me fall forward. No. Centre half forward. I think I played in the under 13s, South Australian schoolboys.
Oh, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah. So that was cool. The tournament was in Mount Gambier, so we were all... billeted, that's the word I'm looking for. We were all billeted out to various families around the area. I was staying in Panola.
Did that work out okay?
That was great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Listen, it's a strange time to ask this question. I should have asked it right at the beginning. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
No.
Okay, so did your mother dote on you? Did she really sort of...
No, she didn't dote on me. I don't think she liked the experience of growing or, you know, moving back in with her parents. And we had to share one room. Like, my mother and I shared the front room, became our bedroom, you know. And I think she was always walking on eggshells that uncontrollable Bob would, you know, break everything in the house and ruin everything.
You didn't, did you?
No, I didn't. She didn't dote on me, but she didn't, by the same token, I never had to learn to wash the dishes. I never had to learn to clean up my room. And, you know, things were done like that. That didn't give me a very good education for living, and as you can actually see by looking around my man cave here.
I feel quite at home, actually. So that must be the British in us. So how long did you live with the family before...
Until I left school.
Secondary school?
Yeah. So until 15.
Okay, well, what was secondary school... Sorry, before we talk about moving, secondary school experience, was that as positive as primary?
I started off in 1A and went to 2B to 3C.
I see a pattern here.
Yes. I think I'd found music.
Okay. Was that finding music via radio or finding it because it was in you and you had an ability?
My mother used to listen to Mario Lanza opera singers like that, or Winifred Atwell playing the piano. And I always used to like melody, you know, but it wasn't until a program started, probably in about 1957, I'd say, 56 or 57, anyway, called the Rockabeat Parade. And it was on at 9 o'clock of a Friday evening, and you got a half an hour of this American rock and roll music. And I was allowed to stay up. It was Friday night. I didn't have to get up for school at 9 o'clock. Oh, yeah. And I loved it, man.
Yeah.
I loved it. My best friend lived just across the road, up a couple of doors. Alan Driver was his name. We used to collect, write down every song we heard and give it marks out of 10 and what was on the flip side and what label was it on and da-da-da, you know, we had these books. The Rockabilly Parade went for about a year and I fell in love with rock and roll, and then I saw a picture of Elvis Presley while I was walking down Rundle Street, it was, Main Street, in some shop window, and that guy's from outer space, yeah. What? And then I heard Heartbreak Hotel. Whoa, I want to do that almost, you know. But it was still just a dream. And
were you a teenager yet, or were you still in your...
I was about 12, 13.
Okay.
And after a while, Alan and I learnt words for some of these songs, and we would put on little concerts for my mother or his dad.
No instruments?
I got a guitar for my 13th birthday. I pestered my mother. And... got it, and with that came 10 free lessons at the South Australian College of Music.
Who definitely weren't for rock and roll.
Yeah. First lesson. This is a guitar. This is the headstock. These are tuning pegs.
Well, this is really going to interest kids who want to learn to play. Yeah.
These are frets.
Oh, dear.
I did the 10, you know. Yeah, so basically I was into music more than I was into anything else, you know, from that point on.
And that sort of had an influence on your secondary schooling then?
Well, I think it did in some way. I think the rebellion that was in the music had gotten through to me in the head, and in a way I was having far too much fun to study.
Mm. Yeah, I understand.
You know, I was always relatively intelligent at school, so, and I didn't have to really try hard. I could generally do what was asked. Yeah, which if you listen, you generally can.
Yes.
So it was just that I was having too much fun and didn't really try, and therefore my marks in the exams weren't super, and they put me down to the next, see if I could handle that better. So I just defied the theory and handled it exactly the same.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but that.
So you mentioned you're getting into this so-called rebellious age group, you know, you're into your teens and... certainly not discouraged by the music you're listening to sort of be rebellious.
It's Saturday night and I just got paid. I'm a fool about my money. I don't try to save. My heart says, go, go, have a time. It's Saturday night and I'm feeling fine. Let's rock it up. Let's shake it up.
So how did things progress from there? Did you start going to any dances? Did they start dances at that
Coca-Cola
period?
Coca-Cola Hi-Fi Club. Bert Newton used to come across from Melbourne and put them on at the Palais Royal, which was in Adelaide and North Terrace. It was an old dance hall that was built in the 20s.
Right.
A great big barn, almost like a hangar, you know, with a curved roof and depth and then the stage down there. So, yeah, I used to start going there. And I learned to jive, you know, which was
really?
The current jiving. Well, when I say I learned, I watched people and copied. But my main purpose was so I could get up the front and see what the band was doing.
So this was live music, not...
It definitely was. I think it was the Penny Rockets, which was Adelaide's first rock and roll band. Brian Pengleys and the Penny Rockets.
Which probably to a young boy, they were great.
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
They were. Totally professional, you know. I think they were old jazz players in their 40s.
Yeah. Well,
they weren't young teenagers. They were, you know.
Yeah.
That's how I sort of I got into that. And then there was a club called the Boomerang Club. But I think that was later. I think that was when I was... I think I had started singing by the time I used to go to the Boomerang Club.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.